This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Bart Bonikowski, associate professor of sociology at Harvard University. Bart is one of the discipline's leading experts on nationalism and populism. He's probably best known for his 2016 ASR article, Varieties of American Popular Nationalism with Paul DiMaggio, and has a bunch of great articles, The Populist Style of American Politics, Ethno-Nationalist Populism, and the Mobilization of Collective Sentiment. All in all, it's a real pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us, Bart.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Joe.
All right. So not everyone here is plugged into political sociology, so maybe it's best to start with some basic concepts. When we talk about nationalism and populism, what are we talking about?
That's a great start. I think there's a lot of confusion about both terms. That confusion is especially rife in public discourse, but also to some degree in scholarship. For a long time, scholars were primarily interested in understanding where nation states came from. How is it the case that we've got states governing a territory and those states are legitimated by people's sense of collective identity, that we're all in this together, there's kind of an imagined community that we are part of? The question was largely a historical one. How did this come to be? There's a lot of research on that, really terrific research, people like Ernest Gellner, Benedict Anderson, and many others. For these scholars, the meaning of nationalism was quite clear. For Ernest Gellner, nationalism is a principle that the cultural boundaries of a state should correspond to its political boundaries, so that essentially the state and the nation correspond to one another. Now, the question, of course, is what defines the cultural boundaries of the nation? And here there are really two varieties of nationalism, civic and ethnic. In countries that were defined by civic nationalism, membership of the nation was largely elective, so that anybody could become a member of the nation as long as they subscribed to the nation's principles, respected its laws and institutions, and felt subjective identification with the nation, some sort of sense of loyalty to it. In ethnic nationalism, on the other hand, membership was much more ascriptive and much more limited. In order to be a legitimate member of the nation, one had to possess the right kind of ancestry, ethnicity, religion, and other immutable characteristics. But what mattered here is that after the founding moment, once countries set off on these tracks, things remained largely unchanged in the future. Once a country became civic or ethnic, it remained civic or ethnic in perpetuity. And so really, nationalism was not relevant after the founding moment. It was relevant when we wanted to compare countries to one another, but it wasn't really relevant for understanding historical change within those countries. And that model has been largely challenged in the last 20, 30 years by scholars like Michael Billig, Rogers Brubaker, and many others, who've pointed out that actually there isn't this singular, coherent national character that we can identify in individual countries. In fact, what there is a much more complicated, fragmented set of principles within each country about what the country means and about what its criteria of legitimate membership are. And so in my own work, I've tried to map that variation in meanings to show how individuals understand their nation, their relationship to the nation, how those understandings differ within national populations, and how that in turn affects politics. So if we use survey data for this purpose, we can measure a whole variety of attitudes that define someone's conception of their nation, and then see whether those response patterns cluster into different groups. And that's precisely what I've done both within the United States in a 2016 ASR paper with Paul DiMaggio and across other countries in other publications. And so the idea is if we look closely at the beliefs of everyday people, it turns out that there's more heterogeneity within countries potentially than across them. If we take a random American, that person's beliefs about the nation may have more in common with a randomly selected French person or Norwegian person than with a compatriot down the road. And these different and occasionally competing understandings of the nation may be latent most of the time, but once in a while, they become important sources of political beliefs and political behaviors. The current political moment is one such instance where existing cleavages around the meaning of the nation that had been latent in the past have become manifest and politically mobilizable. And then that's, in fact, what has happened with the election of Donald Trump in the United States, but also the election of other nationalist populist candidates and parties in Europe and elsewhere. I can get into populism, but I imagine you may want to prod that a little bit.
Well, I want to, first, before we move on, can you give us a sense concretely of what nationalism looks like here in America? Like, give our listeners a sense of, like, concretely, how do you see it in day-to-day life? How can you locate it? Where can you find a concrete referent for it?
Well, the one very clear example of nationalism at work were the Democratic National Convention and the Republican National Convention, where you see two very different understandings of what America is on display. In the Democratic National Convention, America is diversity. It's about showcasing the ethnic, racial, religious diversity of the American society. It's about the fact that everyone belongs. We're a nation of immigrants. So it's a very different vision than a vision presented at the Republican National Convention. And that was a vision of a nation in deep trouble, a nation where traditional conceptions of mostly white, male, Christian America are under threat, a nation that's basically on a sharp decline. And part of that decline, it's due to the influx of immigrants and growing diversity and the possibility of America becoming a majority-minority nation. And so essentially, you've got two very different notions of what America is, who gets to count as a legitimate American, and what the future of the country holds. And so those are just two examples. But there's kind of a sense in which for a long time, there was this notion that America is a fundamentally a liberal, inclusive, egalitarian society. Mm-hmm. And slavery and Jim Crow, those were just exceptions from that sort of norm. And that's a very problematic position. There's a great book by Rogers Smith called Civic Ideals, which directly challenges that notion. And he argues that, in fact, if you look at American history, there's always been this competition between alternative views of America. One egalitarian and inclusive and progressive, another deeply ethno-nationalist, racist, and exclusionary. He has a third model to it as well. And he actually empirically traces the competition between these alternative views of America in citizenship law over a good century and shows that sometimes one becomes dominant, sometimes the other, and you can see the residues of this competition in the law. That's been a big inspiration for my own work. I do something very similar, although not historically, not in the law, but in survey data to show that if you look at Americans today and we ask them about things such as what are the criteria of legitimate membership in the nation, who gets to belong, who does not, what are you proud of about America, both the nation and the state? Do you think America is a better country than others? Do you think Americans are better than others? If you ask these kinds of questions and you look at the way in which the response patterns cluster, you end up with very different competing models of American nationhood that are present today in the American population and that shape people's politics.
So from what, you know, very modest amount of reading I've done in the area of nationalism, there's, of course, like a really significant body of work that's doing attitudinal surveys and looking into that. I'm wondering from your vantage point, what do you think are exciting methods to measure or study nationalism beyond, you know, surveys of attitudes?
So within survey research, there are various options, some of which are more fruitful than others. For a long time, people treated nationalist attitudes on a kind of variable by variable basis. And then showed, well, you know, if you look at the way in which some people say that to be truly American, you have to be white or have American ancestry. Let's see if that correlates somehow with some other attitude, with some other variable. And that, you know, that's an interesting approach, and it shows that some people are more nativist than others. But I think the way I've tried to analyze survey data is using a slightly different methodology, and that is latent class analysis, which allows you to inductively pull out clusters of people who share a similar pattern of responses. And what that allows you to do is essentially capture these cultural communities or groups of people with distinct conceptions of nationhood. So that, you know, that's still staying within the realm of survey research, but using methods that are compatible with what we know about cultural beliefs from cultural sociology. And that is that cultural beliefs are relational, that they constitute schemas or models of specific domains of social life, and that we can use survey data to measure that. But beyond surveys, there are many other methods that can be used, some of which I have used myself. For instance, experimental research is obviously a very useful paradigm for studying nationalism. And I'm thinking, for example, of some of the work by Rob Willer, which showed that if you expose people to pictures of politicians, including Barack Obama, with lighter or darker shading of the skin, that actually ends up activating racial resentments that then translate to support for the Tea Party. You know, and I've used experimental research myself to see, for instance, well, what's the relationship between populism and nationalism? If you prime people with just anti-elite talk, does that then lead to greater antipathy towards ethnic and racial minorities? And and it turns out that it does. This is using survey experiments. So, you know, that's an interesting tool for trying to identify some of the mechanisms that link up nationalism with other ideological belief systems and with political preferences. The third method or family of methods that I would mention is computational text analysis. And that's a research tradition that I've relied on quite a bit, for particularly for studying populism, but increasingly for nationalism as well. And that is to actually look at what kinds of appeals are being made in political discourse and which types of nationalism are being primed by politicians. And so, you know, I mentioned the example of the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Those entailed very different imagery, very different discourse about America, which then activated belief systems, which are themselves heterogeneous within American society. And so I think studying political discourse and connecting it to belief systems is a very fruitful way forward. And that's where we can bring together text analysis with survey research and perhaps experimental designs.
And populism, how's it different from nationalism?
So frequently the two are conflated, and I think that's a problem analytically from a research standpoint. It's a problem in terms of public debate as well. So populism at its very core is a way of framing political claims in a way that juxtaposes a virtuous people with some sort of a corrupt elite. Mm-hmm. It's a black and white Manichaean way of seeing the world, and it's a deeply moral form of discourse. Mm-hmm. There's also, in most varieties of populism, this inherent skepticism toward representative institutions, a sense that those institutions represent the elites and not the true interests of the people. Because it's actually a pretty thin ideology, as some have framed it, or in my view, it's a pretty thin form of political discourse. So there isn't much content there beyond this people versus elite opposition. Mm-hmm. It can be attached to a whole variety of ideologies. So you can have right-wing populism, you can have left-wing populism, and they differ quite a bit in their ideological content. A lot of right-wing populism has combined these anti-elite claims with nationalist appeals and nationalist rhetoric, and particularly ethno-nationalist appeals. On the left, for most part, this anti-elite rhetoric has targeted big business, capital, CEOs, bankers, and so forth. It's been largely an economic populism that is also moral. It's also binary in this people versus elite opposition, but it doesn't tend to have an ethno-nationalist dimension to it. That's sort of an empirical regularity, not a theoretical precept, right? So it is possible for left-wing populism to attach itself to ethno-nationalism too. Mm-hmm. And there are some examples of that in the past. There's some instances of labor movements defending white workers, not just any workers. That's where you see kind of a left-wing populism combined with potentially with ethno-nationalism. But for most part, these days, left-wing populism is largely economic and not ethno-nationalist. There's a term coined by John Judas, the journalist who wrote a terrific book on populism, where he says that right-wing populism is triadic. It is people versus the elites, and then the ethnic minorities that are ostensibly protected by the elites against the interests of everyday people, right? So it's the three components to it, whereas on the left, it's really a binary people versus elite distinction.
Is it though, Bart? Like, I mean, there's a lot of narrative about like rural white voters voting against their interests. I mean, don't you need the hapless stooges to reconcile like the view with the democratic institutions?
So I'm going to clarify that a little bit. So the notion that white Midwestern, you know, working class voters are voting for right-wing populism suggests that what exactly?
Like it's interesting. It sounds to me like a mirror image of the left rhetoric that, you know, millionaires and elites take advantage and protect rural whites. It's like who vote against their interests. Like I have a sense that like both sides have to rely on like elites who are manipulating, you know, some unfavorable other popular group. Maybe it's not.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. No, I haven't seen that articulated anywhere in scholarship. But in some ways, you may be right. That much as on the right, the fear is fear of minorities and anger directed at elites that supposedly cater to them. On the left, there is to some degree a scapegoating and moral panic about white working class voters who are essentially being favored and potentially exploited by right-wing populist politicians. So that's certainly interesting.
Well, it's a generic rhetorical strategy where you fill in the blanks with the actors. That's the only point I was...
I think there's a qualitative difference, though, in the way in which the threats are framed, right? So there is much less emphasis on the left in being terrified of white workers coming over and engaging in criminal acts and threatening national security. And, yeah, you know, it's more about the fact that they are supporting the party that you're opposed to. Mm. Whereas on the right, it's very much a national nationalist rhetoric. It's about the fact that, say, in the US case, America is rightfully a white Anglo-Saxon
right.
Protestant nation, and immigrants and minorities, Muslims, are coming and threatening our livelihood and our security mm-hmm. and the very core of what America is. So it's a slightly different or very different configuration of beliefs. It's really an anti-elite populist rhetoric that's attached to a deeply ethno-nationalist ideological disposition.
What's your sense of what's driving this, this ethno-nationalism? Like, is it a grassroots phenomenon, or do you see it as purposefully being cultivated? Like, where's it coming from in a macro sense? What are the social forces that are causing this?
So that's the million-dollar question. And my work for a long time was primarily preoccupied with mapping out the different configurations of nationalist beliefs and trying to understand how they relate to political behavior without really engaging in the rise of the radical right, because a lot of this work preceded Donald Trump and preceded some of the developments in Europe. And then similarly, my work in populism was really trying to understand, where does this political style come from? Why do politicians engage in populist discourse and sometimes and not others? And in fact, the paper I wrote about this wasn't dealing with the radical right. It was dealing with presidential candidates in the United States between 1952 and 1996. It turns out that, as Hofstadter and others and Lipset have argued, populism is a very common trope in American politics, and it long has been. So a lot of the work that I did prior to 2015 was trying to understand these phenomena in their own right as important political topics. But of course, what happened after that is that the radical right had a number of victories. The 2016 election was obviously won, Brexit, the entry of radical right parties into governments in Europe, and their continued good fortunes in elections generally. So I was getting a lot of questions about how my work on nationalism and populism relates to the rise of radical right politics. Mm-hmm. And so I've certainly written about that and thought about that quite a bit. It's a tricky thing to study because there's a lot of similarity across cases on one hand in the form that this politics takes and some of the basis of support for it, but there are also a lot of case-specific particularities. And so some people, particularly economists, not surprisingly, argue that it all boils down to economics. The people who are voting for radical right parties, I'm using that umbrella broadly to encompass Donald Trump as somebody who captured the Republican Party as well as a number of upstart parties in Europe. So the reason that people are favoring this form of politics is that they're responding to precariousness in their day-to-day economic situation. Whether it's trade shocks, whether it's capital mobility, whether it's automation, these are all things that are endangering people's livelihood. As a result, people are obviously upset and they're turning against elites and toward anti-establishment candidates. And so that's one diagnosis of the problem. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the data, it turns out that this is actually quite problematic. For instance, in the United States, the working class that's in particularly dire economic circumstances is not white. It's predominantly African American and Latino. These are folks who are working in precarious jobs and having a really tough go of it. Yet they're not voting for Donald Trump. Mm. It also turns out that if you look at the base of support for Trump, there's a question of whether you're looking at the primary or the general election, but income doesn't map very well onto Trump support. Hmm. Education and occupation a little better, but still not quite as well as you would need to bolster the economics argument. Hmm. Instead, what really explains it is holding racially resentful views.
Yeah.
It's what I would group under ethno-nationalism. Right. And so we need a multi-causal explanation.
Sure.
I think it's clear that the support of radical right parties tend to be white or belong to the majority ethno-racial group. Mm-hmm. They tend to hold lower levels of education. They tend to live outside of urban centers. And they tend to be both ethno-nationalist in the disposition and have low levels of trust in institutions. And so for some of them, its chances are that it is their direct economic experience that's causing their frustration. Mm. For some, it is a mediated sense of economic threat. That is, they see through social networks, through the media, that people like them mm-hmm. are not doing well. And the question of who are people like them becomes really important. And obviously, race, class plays an important role here.
Right.
And then for others, it is the sense of being told that you can't think or speak a certain way. Mm-hmm. And if you want to sort of boil all this down to one overarching category, I would say that what supporters of the radical right are reacting to is a perception of collective status threat. Mm. That is, my family may not have been the richest in town or the richest in the state of the country, but people like me were viewed as the heart of the nation. Mm-hmm. We were at the top of the ethno-racial status hierarchy. Mm-hmm. That's changing. That's no longer the case. And its manifestations are economic, they're cultural. It's about whether you see yourself and people like you represented in popular culture, whether you see people like you represented by the politicians who are in Washington. It's whether you think people like you can do well economically, whether your children can do well economically, or whether you see your group as declining over time. Now, why would people think that the status hierarchy is under threat? I mean, objectively speaking, white Americans are still doing much better than pretty much any other group, and similar statistics can be cited for other countries. And the answer is that there are a number of perceived structural shocks that have taken place simultaneously or in close proximity to one another, some of which are actual real shocks on the ground, others are fears of things that might happen. And so obviously some of these are demographic, the notion that the demographic makeup of the United States is changing rapidly, and that the same is true in European countries. And that makes these white supporters of the radical right feel that they're on the way to becoming a minority. There are national security threats like terrorism that have been experienced over the past while that also create a sense of insecurity and fear. There are migration shocks and migration crises like the refugee crisis in Europe, like past waves of immigration to the United States that are often linked together with terrorism and other sources of anxiety by opportunistic politicians. And of course, there are economic crises and rising inequality and a variety of other changes. And the point is that some of this stuff, again, is experienced directly by people, but a lot of it is really sort of drummed up by politicians and by media personalities. And these fears are then channeled toward intergroup resentment. So you're in an economically precarious position? Well, look, African Americans and Latinos are doing so well. Oh, you're scared of terrorism? Well, look, there are more people coming across the border and coming after you. You don't see people like you in popular culture. You don't see politicians representing people like you. That's because we're being led by liberal cosmopolitans who favor minorities over you. And so there's this element of scapegoating and fear-mongering that makes the politics of ethno-nationalism work really well, particularly when it's attached to populist anti-elite arguments as well. And the radical right has come up with this really effective formula for bringing together nationalism, populism, and authoritarianism. And these three elements of radical right ideology have certain elective affinities with one another. So populism critiques the elites and glorifies the people, while nationalism helps fill in the blank in terms of who the people are. Authoritarianism allows for a set of measures that will help oust those in power and ensure the continued dominance of the groups who are supporting radical actors. So there's kind of an elective affinity between these three elements that has made this particular discursive mix especially effective during these moments of structural change and a growing sense of status anxiety for all of these multiple structural reasons I just mentioned.
How much of it, I always wonder with this, like how much of this is a top-down phenomenon? Like, I see Trump's election as a freakish low probability event that came to fruition, right? Like a 10% probability event happens one time out of 10, and that's how I interpret Trump. And like, I wonder, had we elected Hillary Clinton, would we still be discussing the issue of ethno-nationalism, or do you think it would have been relegated to a footnote and will lose salience when Trump is displaced? Or do you think that I'm naive and like many people, I just missed the brute force of like a long-term groundswell of ethno-nationalism and that it is a long-term force that's here to stay?
So there's a lot in that question, yeah, or in those sure. questions.
Yeah, it's probably a bad question.
So no, but in a good sense. First, I agree that the Trump election was in many ways a chance event. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to the general elections, Republicans are voting Republican, Democrats are voting Democrat. Mm-hmm. Really, why Trump won the general election is not that interesting a question. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it went one way or the other can be ascribed to a whole slew of factors. Redistricting, Russian interference, Clinton's campaign failures, you know, whichever is your favorite cause, you can find some evidence for it. Mm-hmm. I think it's much more interesting to ask why Trump was able to capture the Republican Party in the primary. I think that's a much bigger puzzle, actually. But even there, you can say, well, it has to do with a specific lineup of candidates this particular year. It could have gone in a variety of ways. Maybe if there were a smaller pool or a stronger candidate opposed to Trump, maybe it would have gone differently. And that's all quite possible. But the fact that it was a low probability of event that panned out for the Republican Party doesn't mean that ethno-nationalism was not relevant prior to the Trump election, nor that it will cease to be important after Trump is out of office. My work has shown that ethno-nationalism, and I don't want to just stick to ethno-nationalism, because actually in my work I show four distinct varieties of nationalism, but two of them share this feature of being exclusionary on ethno-racial grounds. So this form of nationalism has long animated the American public and the publics of other contemporary democracies. It's been associated with anti-immigrant policy preferences, with anti-immigrant views, with opposition to certain forms of redistribution, with welfare chauvinism. And so there's been this reservoir of voters for whom these are strong beliefs, but who haven't always been voting on these beliefs. And I think that's an important point to make, is actually, if you look at aggregate trends over a long period of time, there is no massive increase in anti-immigrant sentiment in the United States or in Europe. There isn't a massive increase in racism in the aggregate. It's a point I made in the 2017 British Journal of Sociology article, and that also comes up in a book that came out this year by John Sides, Michael Tesler, and Lynn Vavreck called Identity Crisis.
So it's like a collective perception phenomenon, is what you're saying?
Well, it's two things. One thing that has happened is that attitudes that were latent previously became activated during the 2016 election and the lead up to it. So, you know, there's always been a subset of the American population that had ethno-nationalist beliefs. It's just that those weren't the main criteria for the votes. And what Trump plugged into was that as a result of the structural changes, some of which I've already addressed, in the 2000s, those ethno-nationalist beliefs became more salient. And his specific form of discourse was very well aligned with those beliefs. That's one thing. The other thing, that paper that I'm wrapping up right now, shows that, in fact, if you look at the distribution of nationalist beliefs across the two parties in the United States, you see big differences. So there's no aggregate increase, but ethno-nationalist beliefs become sorted into the Republican Party, whereas the Democratic Party becomes less ethno-nationalist over time. And so you've got partisan sorting, which is has been documented in other domains of social and cultural life over the last 20 years, whereby the Republican Party becomes an ethno-nationalist, white nationalist party over time. And so these kinds of claims and these beliefs become much better aligned on the Republican side, allowing Trump to succeed. And you see something very similar across European countries. So it's not about a groundswell of new beliefs and new attitudes. It's really about the realignment across parties and their activation and increased salience over time. And then the last thing I'll say directly to your question about whether, if it hadn't been for Trump, this wouldn't be a topic of great interest in the U.S., you're probably right in the sense that we wouldn't have as much ink spilled by academics and journalists on it. I'd probably still be writing on it, but hey, it's just one person. But my sense is that there, another Trump would come. And in fact, that is the current danger. We have a president who is clearly appealing to ethno-nationalism and who is appealing to white nationalism and racism in the population, who's pursuing largely ethno-nationalist policies to the degree that Trump is making good on any of his promises. It is largely those that have to do with ethno-nationalism and catering to his ethno-nationalist base. He's not really governing as a populist. He's not really doing much to take down the elites, right? So he campaigned as a populist and a nationalist. He's governing largely as an ethno-nationalist to the degree that he's actually governing. And that brings me to the point that he's not a very competent politician. And that suggests to me that once Trump is out of office, the basis of his support is not just going to disappear. There will continue to be a large segment of the population that is disaffected with institutions and elites and that holds deeply ethno-nationalist views. And you can imagine a candidate coming along who is as skillful as Trump at campaigning, but much more skillful than Trump at governance. And then we'll have to see how American democracy fares. So whether Trump is here or not and what happens after he is gone is very much something that will be shaped by ethno-nationalism and populism as analytical concepts and belief systems and forms of political claims making.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.